Katra Podcast Conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome. Imagine, if you will, a time filled with knights in shining armor, huge battles, clashing kingdoms, all captured by this one amazing storyteller. We're talking, of course, about the 14th century. It feels, well, almost mythical now, doesn't it?
It really does. So distant.
But it holds these surprisingly relevant lessons about people and how history itself gets written. Today, we're doing a deep dive into Jean-François Sartre's massive work, his Chronicles.
It's quite the undertaking.
Right. And our mission isn't just to give you a dry history lesson. Oh, no. We want to explore these Chronicles as, well, more than just a record. It's this vivid, sometimes pretty biased, but hugely influential story.
Definitely biased. That's key.
Exactly. And it shaped how we understand medieval chivalry, the whole mindset of that era, and maybe even how we think about writing history today. Think of this as your shortcut, your inside track, to understanding a really pivotal time through the eyes of its most famous, well, chronicler.
He really set the standard for a certain kind of history writing.
He did. What were the big moments, the noble acts worth remembering? Froissart asked that, and we're going to dig into his answer. It's quite a subjective answer, too.
Very subjective. That's part of its fascination.
So who was this guy? Jean-François Sartre. He dedicated his whole life to capturing his time. Born around 1337, French-speaking, a cleric, a poet, and crucially, a court historian.
And importantly, from Hainaut, right? That little region sort of sandwiched between France and the Empire.
Yes, which probably gave him a bit of a unique viewpoint, maybe less tied down to one single kingdom, at least initially.
Good point. Access to different courts, different perspectives.
But what really makes him stand out, I think, is his method. He wasn't, you know, some monk hiding away writing.
Not at all.
He was this tireless traveler, always on the move, crisscrossing Britain, France, Flanders. It's like modern Belgium and the Netherlands, parts of it Spain, Italy.
An incredible amount of travel for the time.
Unbelievable. And he deliberately sought people out. Veterans, heralds, squires, lords. He was collecting stories, anecdotes, eyewitness accounts, often like right after things happened.
It's almost journalistic, isn't it? For the 14th century, anyway.
It feels very modern in that way.
It really does. He wasn't like an academic historian, as we'd think of one. More like a medieval war correspondent, maybe. His authority wasn't from books. It was from being there, from talking to the people involved.
Experience, yeah.
He wasn't just listing facts. He was immersing himself, you know, really getting inside the heads of the aristocracy he wanted to write about. That dual role observer and, well, kind of a participant in their world. It gives his work this psychological depth. It's pretty rare for the time. He got their values, their customs.
And his early career, that really helped shape that perspective, didn't it? His patrons.
Oh, absolutely. Hugely important. His most significant early patron was Philippa of Hainaut. She became Queen of England, Edward III's wife.
Right. The connection from his home region.
Exactly. And that gave him just incredible access to the English court. And you can totally see that influence. Book Eye of the Chronicles. It's got a very clear pro-English slant.
You can't miss it.
No. It reflects the stories, the viewpoints he was hearing there in her service. Later on, though, as his patrons changed, his perspective sometimes shifts a bit, too. That's really key to understanding the whole work.
So let's get to the Chronicles themselves. What are they actually about? What was he trying to do?
Well, like you said, it wasn't about writing modern analytical history, you know, dissecting causes and effects in a neutral way. Forget that.
Right.
Froissart wanted to create this grand sweeping story, a narrative that would record, but more importantly, glorify the chivalric deeds of the nobility. Mm-hmm. Western Europe, mainly the first half of the Hundred Years' War. He was interested in valor, honor, the ambitions of kings, princes, knights, the big players.
Capturing the great deeds.
Exactly. He explicitly said his goal was, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, so that the honorable and noble adventures and feats of arms may be notably registered and put in perpetual memory.
Perpetual memory. That's
me. Whereby the brave and hardy may have and take therefrom example and encouragement in well-doing. So it's like a moral guide, almost a PR piece for the chivalric class as much as it is history.
A textbook on how to be a good knight almost.
Kind of. And it's vast. Huge. Covers roughly 1322 to 1400. It takes you on this really vivid chronological ride through wars, politics, social changes.
Tracy Poitiers.
All the big ones. Royal courts in London, Paris. The scope is just epic. He's trying to capture the whole spirit of the age, but crucially, as understood by the ruling elite.
So less about, say, the average farmer's life.
Oh, much less. It's not just who won which battle, it's the pageantry, the personal dramas, the whole performance of it all. It really does feel like this living document of the 14th century, but specifically for and about those in power.
Okay, let's take that journey then through the four main books as Froissart laid them out. Book one, often called the English Ascendancy, right? Covers about 1325 to 1378.
That's the one.
Longest part, most famous, and as we said, definitely showing that pro-English view from his time with Queen Philippa. It sets up the Hundred Years' War and covers those early, pretty stunning English wins.
Stunning is the word.
And what wins they were. Think about the Battle of Crecy, 1346. It's like Froissart's masterpiece of description, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You can almost feel the chaos. French knights charging uphill right into that storm of English longbow arrows. He talks about bravery on both sides, sure, but he really highlights the English tactics.
It's the longbow factor.
Crucial.
Then you have the Siege of Calais in 1347.
Yeah.
That famous story, almost legendary now, of the six burghers offering their lives and Queen Philippa begging King Edward for mercy.
A classic Froissart moment, high drama.
He presents it as this powerful display of chivalry, mercy, sacrifice, the king's power to grant clemency. And of course, Poitiers in 1356, another massive English victory. The Black Prince's big moment.
Exactly. Framed around Edward the Black Prince's heroism and how courteously, how honorably he treated the captured French King John II. It's like the perfect example of how Froissart thought knights should behave.
Yeah, those moments really cement that narrative of English success and the chivalric ideal in book one. But then moving into book two, which covers roughly 1378 to 1385, things start to shift, don't they?
How so?
Well, his perspective gets a bit more balanced. His patronage had moved on from the English court. He was serving other lords. And this period sees the French, under Charles V, actually start winning back territory. The geographical focus broadens, too.
Interesting.
And what's really fascinating is he starts documenting the Great Schism, the Papal Schism, rival popes claiming authority, that adds this whole layer of religious conflict on top of the political mess.
Wow. Okay, so it's getting more complex.
Definitely. But book two also shows us something else, something quite stark about his worldview.
I think I know where you're going. A common people.
Precisely. It starkly reveals that aristocratic lens. He describes the Jacquerie, the peasant uprising in France in 1358, and the peasants' revolt in England in 1381.
How does he describe them?
With absolute horror and disgust, palpable disgust, he calls the rebels savage beasts, wicked men driven by just base urges, their suppression. Totally righteous and necessary in his view.
So no attempt to understand why they might be revolting?
None whatsoever. It's incredibly revealing for us today. It just hammers home the class divide and how history was written by the elite, for the elite. Their voices are just silenced.
A sobering reminder. Okay, so after that, book three takes a bit of a turn. A Journey into Chivalry, covering about 1385 to 1388.
Yeah, this one feels different, more like a travelogue almost. It celebrates the kind of international brotherhood of the knightly class.
How does he do that?
A big chunk is based on his actual journey to the court of Gaston de Foix down in Orthez near the Pyrenees. He paints it as this amazing, vibrant hub, knights from all over Europe meeting up, swapping stories about campaigns in Spain, Portugal.
Like a convention for knights.
Sort of. And he uses that setting to tell these quite romanticized tales. Like the Battle of Otterburn in 1388 between the Scots and English. There, the focus is as much on honor and bravery in defeat as it is on winning. It really pushes this idea of chivalry as this shared transnational code, like a club.
A very exclusive club.
Very. And then we get to the final book, book four, The Twilight of an Era, covering roughly 1389 to 1400.
Twilight sounds ominous.
It has a much more somber, maybe even disillusioned tone. Froissart's an old man now, writing about events that seem to signal the decline of that whole chivalric age he admired so much.
Like what?
Well, a big one is the deposition of Richard II in England. He details Richard's slide into tyranny and then his overthrow by Henry Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV. This deeply disturbs Froissart.
Right.
Because it breaks the natural order as he saw it. A divinely appointed king being overthrown by his own subjects. That was profoundly wrong in his worldview.
A crack in the system.
A huge crack. And this book also includes this harrowing account of the Crusade of Nicopolis in 1396, a total disaster, a European crusading army against the Ottoman Turks.
What went wrong?
Arrogance, terrible tactics, lack of discipline, leading to just catastrophic defeat. It feels like this tragic postscript, a failure of the very chivalric system he'd spent his life championing. It ends his huge narrative on a pretty downbeat note.
Wow. quite a journey through those books. Okay, so we've gone through the sweep of history as he saw it. Let's zoom out a bit. Beyond the battles, the kings, the ups and downs,
yeah.
What are the big core ideas that Frieshardt leaves us with? What really sticks?
Yeah, good question. What are the undercurrents? Well, first and foremost, number one has to be the glorification of chivalry.
Right. That's central.
Absolutely paramount. His whole story is built around illustrating the chivalric code. Prowess, that's prowess in arms, loyalty, honor, courtesy, generosity. Battles weren't just fights. They were chances to show off these virtues.
Like the Black Prince being courteous to the captured king.
Exactly. For Froissart, chivalry gave meaning to what was, let's face it, a violent and chaotic world. It was this moral, this aesthetic framework that, in his view, elevated the nobility. What's maybe surprising is how completely he commits to it, often sort of glossing over the ugly bits of war.
A second big idea.
Second, and this is so important, is the aristocratic monopoly on history. We touched on this, but it's fundamental. The chronicles are written by a courtier for nobles. History is made by kings and knights, period.
Everyone else.
Common people. They're either just not there, invisible, or when they do show up, like in the peasant revolts, they're a dangerous mob that needs controlling. It reveals this completely top-down worldview. Their side of the story doesn't exist for Froissart. The aha moment here is realizing just how much of history for centuries was basically elite propaganda.
Really makes you question who gets to write the official story even today.
Absolutely. Third, there's the spectacle and pageantry of war. Froissart doesn't just report battles, he revels in them as these glorious dramatic shows.
How do you mean?
He loves describing the sights and sounds, the banners flying, the sun gleaming on armor, the trumpets, the individual acts of daring do. It's almost cinematic. He portrays war as the ultimate stage for noble character.
So filtering out the mud and blood a bit.
Often, yes. The unexpected thing is how much he focuses on the aesthetic, the performance, the individual quest for honor, rather than the collective suffering or the strategic realities. It's a very curated view of war.
Okay, what else?
Fourth is the power of fortune, or fortuna. There's this deep medieval sense of instability running through everything. The wheel of fortune, you know? It's always turning.
Kings captured, rulers overthrown.
Exactly. Powerful kings get captured, legitimate rulers get deposed. Glory is temporary. It's a reminder that you need noble conduct no matter what, because fate is fickle. It's this constant low hum of uncertainty beneath the surface.
A very medieval concept.
Very. Fifth, the pursuit of glory and perpetual memory. We mentioned this, but the characters are so driven by glory-achieving fame, a reputation that lasts after you die.
And Froissart's book is the way to get that.
Precisely. He sees his chronicles as the vehicle for their immortality. So it's this fascinating feedback loop. His writing fuels their desire for glory, and their actions give him material. He's both recording and encouraging the behavior.
Wow. And finally.
Finally, number six, the personal and feudal nature of loyalty. This is key for understanding the politics. Loyalty wasn't like our modern nationalism, not to an abstract France or England.
It was to your lord.
Exactly. Intensely personal, intensely feudal. Your primary allegiance was to your immediate lord. That explains all the complex, shifting alliances that can seem really confusing to us now. It wasn't betrayal in the same way we might see it. It was about fulfilling your direct feudal obligations.
That's a really helpful set of core ideas.
Yeah.
You know, listening to all this, what strikes me is that Froissart wasn't just a recorder. He was a storyteller, a real craftsman.
Oh, absolutely. A master storyteller.
He knew how to make things stick. What are some of those really memorable moments or phrases, the things that just jump out and encapsulate his whole project?
That's a great way to put it. He definitely knew how to package his ideas. Well, one has to be his own mission statement right there in the prologue, so that the honorable and noble adventures and feats of arms may be notably registered and put in perpetual memory, whereby the brave and hardy may have and take therefrom example and encouragement in well-doing.
Sets out his stall right away.
Completely. It tells you everything. It's not just facts. It's inspiration. It's a moral guide. It's kind of a shocking admission of purpose for someone we label a historian today, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
What else? Then that scene with the burghers of Calais. It's pure drama. The six citizens, ropes around their necks, offering their lives. And then Queen Philippa weeping, pleading with King Edward. Gentle sire, I pray you for the love of the Son of the Holy Mary and for the love of me that you will have mercy on these six men.
So powerful.
It's like his whole worldview in miniature. High stakes drama, the power of royalty, and that chivalric virtue of mercy embodied by a noble lady. you can see why that scene became so iconic. It's incredibly effective storytelling.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, his general attitude on the nature of war. He often describes it, and I'm paraphrasing here, like, a battle is a grand and noble affair to see and consider. You hear the cries, see the banners of great lords, watch brave men test themselves for honor.
Again, focusing on the spectacle.
Exactly. It highlights his deliberate choice to, well, filter out a lot of the suffering and focus on the performance, the individual pursuit of glory.
And what about that sense of instability, Fortuna?
Right. Thinking about the instability of fortune, especially with Richard II's downfall, he writes something like, "Thus do the fortunes of this world go. Nothing stays stable. Look how a king, once so great and powerful, is now trapped in a castle, betrayed by his own people."
Captures that melancholy later tone.
Perfectly. That medieval theme of Fortuna, how quickly power can vanish, it really underlines the fragility of it all.
And finally, summing up chivalry itself.
Yeah, maybe the best way to capture the essence of chivalry for him is something like, "A knight without honor is no knight at all, no matter how good he is in a fight."
So character over just skill.
Exactly. It encapsulates his belief that true nobility demanded ethical conduct, not just being tough. It was the moral compass for his heroes, even if they didn't always follow it.
Okay, so Froissart's world. Knights, chivalry, feudal loyalties. It feels miles away. But you've mentioned relevance. How does reading this this medieval chronicle actually connect to us today?
That's the fascinating part. Despite the centuries, I think the chronicles offer some really profound insights. First, just understanding the power of narrative.
How stories shape things.
Precisely. Froissart is exhibit A in how compelling stories frame events, create heroes, villains, and justify social structures. In our world, saturated with media, spin, fake news, studying Froissart gives you this critical lens. How are stories being built now to serve specific interests? He was like the ultimate medieval PR guy, in a way.
Seeing the mechanics of narrative construction.
Exactly. Second, you get real insights into leadership and influence. The chronicles are just packed with leaders, some brilliant like Edward III or the Black Prince, some disastrous like Richard II.
The case study gallery.
Totally. It offers these timeless lessons about power dynamics, decisiveness, generosity, inspiring loyalty, versus the dangers of tyranny, arrogance, losing touch. It's a masterclass in leadership styles and their consequences.
Hmm. Applicable anywhere, really.
Third, and this is maybe uncomfortable but important, is recognizing the othering of opponents. His depiction of the peasant rebels as wicked men, beasts.
Yeah, that was stark.
It's a classic example of how a ruling class uses narrative to dehumanize its enemies and justify controlling them. It's a powerful reminder for us to look critically at how marginalized groups, or just the opposition, are portrayed in our own media and politics. Who are the beasts in today's stories? It forces you to ask that question.
A really critical skill.
And finally, maybe more philosophical, is reflecting on the human need for meaning and glory. Those knights, they desperately wanted their deeds remembered, their glory to last.
That drive for legacy.
It's a fundamental human thing, isn't it? The book makes you think, what codes, what values drive our society now? How do we seek our own kind of perpetual memory? What do we want to be remembered for?
It really does make you think about whose stories get told and why, even now. And the Chronicles also give us this amazing insight into how societies change. Right? Seeing that shift from feudal loyalty towards something, well, maybe closer to nations, even if it wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
And maybe how little human ambition changes.
That's a great point. Ultimately, I think the biggest takeaway from Froissart is the unique, incredibly immersive window he gives us into that medieval aristocratic mindset.
Yeah.
You finish reading it and you feel like you understand on an intuitive level what it was like to see the world through the lens of chivalry, mm-hmm. where personal honor and glory in battle were like the ultimate measures.
It's the subjectivity that's valuable.
Exactly. Its lasting insight is seeing history itself as this deeply subjective literary act. Froissart wasn't just a neutral recorder. He was a brilliant storyteller who picked and chose, who shaped events to celebrate the values of his patrons. Its unique value isn't objective truth. It's in its magnificent influential bias.
So what does this all mean for us right now? Froissart's chronicles, they make us question the past, definitely, but also our present. If a Froissart were writing about our time, what chivalric deeds, whatever the modern equivalent is, would he glorify?
Good question.
And maybe more importantly, whose stories, whose perspectives would he inevitably ignore or twist? It really makes you wonder, who are the Froissarts of today? Who's shaping the big narratives we consume and remember? And, well, who benefits from those stories? That's a powerful thought to leave you with.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.